a couple folks, but we do expect Representative Gilliam and the other members who aren't here yet, so hopefully they'll join us very quickly. We do have a couple members who weren't with us last time, so if folks want to go around and introduce yourself, just to make sure everybody knows who they are, we'll go this way, because staff that are reporting to us will get introduced when their agenda item comes up. But just to introduce myself, I'm Jean Atkins, Secretary of State and Chair of this task force.
Oh, sorry, I thought you said that way. Okay. Justin Delaney, by day I work for The Standard, and I, as I said last time, I was suckered into serving on this committee by the Oregon Business Council and OBA, I believe.
Dave Ellison, I'm here representing non-affiliated voters.
Nikki Fisher, representing the BUS Project and Voter Registration Organization.
I'm Rob Harris with the Independent Party.
I'm Margie Hughes with the Oregon Republican Party.
Trent Lutz, representing the Democratic Party of Oregon.
I'm Kyle Markley. I was a nominee from the Libertarian Party.
Dave Rosenfeld, representing non-affiliated voters.
And I'm Norman Pearl, representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon.
Me? I'm Brian Boquist, state senator, and I voted no, so therefore Courtney put me on the committee. Oh. He does that all the time, by the way.
So, do we have any business that you, Aaron, want to catch us up on before we get started with the presentation?
Just a couple of things. At our last meeting, there were a series of questions we had asked Legislative Council to come back with, and Dan is working on those diligently. He is up against some other LC deadlines, so he's trying to navigate both worlds right now. He did provide us, though, the case list. There was a question asked if we could have case law inside all of those. He did get that to us, and that's been posted on OLIS. He will continue to keep coming back with those answers. I know he is listening to us right now, and so as we go through our discussion today, if questions come up and we need him to come up here, he will dart right up here and be here to help us. But he is listening, so don't hesitate to put questions out there for him to hear, and he will continue to navigate those questions. He will be back, though, for sure in November to present any questions that haven't been resolved yet and additional questions and information for that meeting. And then for today and at some point when we get to, you'll notice in front of you just a couple of items. Most materials got posted online. I did print out the large charter document. It's a large document. I did not want you to have to try to navigate at your office or home to print out. All of the materials were posted online. I did send out links to that. We had some difficulty with one of the links not working, so I sent that out again last night. Hopefully everybody was able to find all those materials. And we will continue to use our website to send out materials that way. You will notice there's one other article in front of you today. That was an article. It's an op-ed piece from Representative Bueller. Representative Gilliam had presented that to me yesterday, and so I wanted to make sure you had it. It has to do with the People's Pledge, which we'll be discussing today in the context of possible solutions to manage independent expenditures. Representative Bueller could not be here today. He is celebrating his anniversary, and so we did say that we would talk about it for him and bring it to as an idea today, and that he may be available at a future meeting to talk about it as we kind of finalize our recommendations. But I just wanted to make sure that was noted, that we do have that before you today as a possible idea for solutions around independent expenditures.
Very good. And we will be going through our work plan. There was a question in between our meetings about at what point we might take back up the question that I had identified was clearly on the minds of many of the legislators who worked on developing this task force, and that was contribution limits and a constitutional amendment. We will come back to that. Not to say you shouldn't mention it today or when we go through are you calling this a charter document?
Yes.
Right, the big document. Start to fill in the blanks there. But we did think that along with last time when we sort of had a little baseline discussion of what's the state of the law with regard to contribution limits and so forth, that it would be good to have a little baseline of information about our reporting requirements in Oregon and sort of get your questions about that and any possible suggestions that there are about how that might be changed or radicalized or made stronger if there's an interest in those as part of the recommendation. So we did invite folks from the Elections Division to come and do this, do a little presentation. Brenda Bays and Jim Williams, our Elections Director, and Brenda Bays, who manages this portion of the elections process, has prepared a PowerPoint, so which is directed this way. In case you didn't know, I might slide out of the way, so I'm not in the way of folks. And I think we probably welcome questions as we go along, but you know they might be answered later in the thing, so maybe let her get kind of through most of it before we start asking questions. We also did ask them, and of course they work with me, so I jumped into that part of the conversation to think about, you know, sort of summary comments that they might have about how the system is working, how it's grown, how it's working. And I'm going to then follow that with some of the issues we've heard that people are interested in potentially that would affect the Org Star system, so we have at least a starting place of ideas if it becomes of greater interest to the task force. So, Jim, Brenda, go for it.
Good morning. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to give you a baseline of campaign finance reporting. Of course, there's not very many slides, and of course, we all know that campaign finance is a lot more than these slides. So thank you for giving us this opportunity. So I'll try and get out of the way here. Oh, that's not going to work. How about here? Okay, prior to 2007, committees were required to file campaign finance information by paper. There were some committees that filed electronically using a tab-limited program that we uploaded to our system, but it was not all committees that did that. And those reports were not accessible to the public. So the electronic files were uploaded by staff into our database for our staff to review. In 2005, the Legislative Assembly passed House Bill 3458 requiring us to provide free of charge an electronic campaign finance reporting system. This system was implemented in January of 2007. ORSTAR stands for Oregon Election System for Tracking and Reporting, and was developed completely in-house by our IT division and some of our staff. There are currently 2,143 committees that are registered in the ORSTAR system. Since the implementation of House Bill 3458, we have 1,736,568 transactions that have been filed into the system. So who must establish a committee? A combination of two or more individuals or a person other than an individual that has solicited contribution, made an expenditure to support or oppose a candidate, measure, or political party. The chief petitioners of an initiative, referendum, or recall petition. The types of committees are candidate committees, political action committees, which are caucus committees, recall committees, measure committees, political parties, or miscellaneous committees. Petition committees are initiative, referendum, and recall petition committees. And all committees that file a committee in ORSTAR must have a dedicated bank account. Are there exceptions to forming a committee? Yes, for a candidate committee. So a candidate committee is not required to establish a committee in ORSTAR if they meet three criteria. They have to meet all three of those criteria. If they do not expect to receive or spend more than $750 in a calendar year, they serve as their own treasurer, and they do not currently have an existing committee already set up in ORSTAR. The deadline to create a committee. So for a candidate committee, they must file a statement of organization, establish their bank account within 3 business days of receiving a contribution, or making an expenditure and no later than the deadline for filing a nominating petition, declaration of candidacy, or a certificate of nomination. For a political action committee, it's 3 days, 3 business days of receiving or spending money. A petition committee must file their statement of organization, form, have their bank account within 3 business days of receiving a contribution, making expenditure, or after filing a prospective petition with the filing officer, so city, county, state elections officers, no later than the petition is approved to circulate for signatures. Committee can file a certificate of limited contribution. This is if they expect to not receive or spend more than $3,500 in a calendar year. They can file the certificate of limited contributions and expenditure in OraStar. That's at the beginning of the year, sometimes during the year, okay, once a year. If, however, the candidate meets the exception rule, which is they don't form a committee at all because they don't expect to receive or spend more than $750, unfortunately, they don't have that same opportunity. They can't file a certificate of limited contributions at that point. They must file all transactions in OraStar, as do independent filers. Okay? Any questions so far? Independent expenditure filers, 2013 Legislative Assembly passed House Bill 3253, requiring persons who have independent expenditures to file electronically in the OraStar system. Previous to that, they filed by paper in our office. We would scan those papers and post them on our website. Now they're required to electronically file those in OraStar. And if a person who makes an independent expenditure of more than $750 in a calendar year for communication that supports or opposes any candidate or measure must register in OraStar. They're required to file all expenditures made or on or after January 1st of the calendar year in OraStar. Any additional expenditures that are made after exceeding the $750 threshold are required to file no later than 7 days or 30 days, depending on when the election cycle is. Example of this is someone purchasing an ad in a newspaper supporting or opposing a candidate or measure without the knowledge of the candidate knowing about the ad. So that's one example of an independent expenditure. When must transactions be filed? Transactions are due no later than 11:59 p.m., 30 calendar days. Typically, it's 30 calendar days after the transaction. However, there are certain time frames when you're closer to an election that they would have to file within 7 days of the transaction. And during the Legislative Assembly, contributions received from January 1st all the way up through sine die must be filed by certain individuals by 2 business days. Those individuals are statewide officials, state legislatures, the governor, someone running for office for governor, someone running for office for state legislature, statewide office, and so forth. Transactions reviewed by the Elections Division. After the deadline for filing your transaction, our staff has 10 business days to review those transactions. And these transactions are transactions that are aggregated at over $100 for contributions and expenditures. So if someone gives a contribution of $50 to a candidate, and that is the only contribution they have given, that is lumped into a miscellaneous category and is not reviewed. When that individual during that calendar year exceeds that $100, then their name, address, occupation, and so forth is provided publicly. Once they review the transactions, if they find any insufficiencies in the transactions, the committee will receive an exam letter from our office indicating that they can correct the transaction within a certain time frame, and a deadline is provided to them. Once the deadline passes, however, if the transaction has not been amended, then penalties may be assessed. If the transactions are corrected within that amendment deadline day, no penalties are assessed for that transaction. There are other campaign finance laws that provide other violations of campaign finance laws other than late or insufficient filings regarding Chapter 260, ORS Chapter 260. If we receive a complaint with evidence of a possible election violation, our office will conduct an investigation for anything that our election office has jurisdiction over. There are some issues that we do not have jurisdiction over other than chapters 246 through 260. If a total calculated penalty for a committee is less than $50, there is no penalty assessed or no violation. So if we calculate the penalty and it is $49 for the penalty, we would not assess that penalty and there would be no violation. So we wouldn't send out a penalty notice to committees. The detail of transactions is disclosed to the public if the aggregate, as I said previously, is over $100. And the following fields that are included in ORSTAR are these fields that I've listed here: transaction, date, type, subtype, payee of personal expenditures, contributors, payees, payment methods, check numbers, the amount of the transaction, interest rates, repayment schedules, descriptions, occupation letter, notes, transaction purposes, transaction association, in-kind contributions, or independent expenditure transactions. And penalties for failure to file timely or sufficient campaign finance transactions. The maximum penalty that can be imposed is 10% of the amount of the late or insufficient transaction. A late transaction reaches the maximum penalty it is filed within 20 business days. However, I do want to note that during legislative session, we are prohibited from providing penalty notices to state legislatures while they're in, state senators, state representatives, while they're in legislative session. Who's responsible for the penalties? So for a candidate committee, the candidate is responsible. For a political action committee, the treasurer is responsible. And for an independent filer, the filer is responsible. Any questions? I'm sure you have lots. Yes.
Can you explain why you're prohibited from providing
notices
to legislators during session?
It's a constitutional requirement that specifies that we cannot provide any kind of penalties to the state legislature while they're in session.
It's
in the Constitution.
It's not just the elections division, but generally speaking, exempt from the civil process of any kind during the course of the session.
Does that mean that you would need a constitutional amendment to authorize the ability to do that, or the Constitution prohibits you from doing that? Does that make sense? Is it like you would need an explicit authorization to be able to do something like that?
Yes, we would.
Okay.
It prohibits it.
It prohibits us from doing it.
I wanted to just make one point clear that might be a question. I just wanted to draw attention to the distinction between an insufficient filing and the reviews that the Elections Division does to say, is all the information appropriate for each transaction or each contribution present in the report versus late filing. There's always a potential penalty for a late filing if you correct the insufficient within the deadlines that they have. Then there is a penalty. So I had to go over that with them yesterday to remind myself.
So a question about ballot measure campaign and when the reporting requirement is triggered. It's obviously a ballot measure being sponsored by a group or an individual takes a lot of groundwork to get to the point where you're actually gathering signatures on the street. So when does the reporting requirement trigger, and has that always been the way it is today?
Good question. So a ballot measure committee is triggered when they are approved to circulate their signatures, and no, it has not always been that way. I can't remember when it has changed.
Well, the petition committee piece of it. I'm Jennifer Hertel, and I work at the Elections Division on the campaign finance team. So relative to your question, I think we would need clarification. So are you talking about a ballot measure committee that
Is it really a petition committee that's supporting the circulation, or is it the group of people that want to support that petition if it does become certified to the measure, or oppose that particular issue?
Well, let's assume, just for sake of discussion, that they're one and the same, that it's an organized group that has some machinery in place to run ballot measures on a regular basis. So okay. Both committees.
So, as Brenda explained, that any initiative petition that is approved to circulate is required to file a petition committee, at which time then their reporting starts immediately. For the purposes of reporting deadlines, in the odd-numbered year, they're on 30-day reporting, essentially, and then in the even-numbered year, they have special reporting requirements where they do the 7-day reporting prior to the primary election, and then they have 2 days of a window where they could be on 30-day, and then they are on 7-day again until the deadline for them to turn in signatures, like for a state initiative, 4 months prior to the date of the election. Once it becomes qualified to the ballot, the petition committee is only there to support the petition process, and so then the appropriate steps would be for the group to file a measure committee. The measure committee can be filed, or we can only accept from process measure committee paperwork once there's a measure certified to the ballot. So once we say that there's enough signatures, even if we haven't given it a measure number, that group is eligible to form their measure committee. When are they required to? Not later than 3 business days after first receiving a contribution or expenditure after the measure's been certified to the ballot, essentially. So once we say that there's enough signatures.
So am I correct to assume then, let's say it's a complex ballot measure affecting sentencing reform, whatever, and there's now a state group that is pushing this issue around the nation, and they spend hundreds of thousands of dollars providing research and data and suggested ballot titles to a group of people within Oregon who work on it for a year leading up to approval for signature gathering. Does all that money spent beforehand get reported at that time, or is that totally dark to the public?
So there's a provision, it's a very short statute that refers to, it's called, we refer to it as the initial asset statute. I want to say that it's 260.078, which says, and it's kind of not in layman's terms, but it says, if the first statement that you file in OreStar, you have a balance in your account, then you shall disclose everything that occurred, before you were able to file a petition committee that gave rise to that balance in your account. So what that means is that all contributions and expenditures would be required to be disclosed, and they're called initial assets. The deadline for filing the initial assets is a little more difficult to explain, but we have an example in the campaign finance manual of how to calculate it. So essentially, it's like, I have a lot of activity that goes on and prior to the filing of the petition, all right? And then I file the petition, and I file my statement of organization. So then the first transaction that occurs, if I file my statement of organization timely, whatever the deadline date for that transaction, that's the deadline date to file all that other activity that happened prior to the filing of the petition. Now, one thing to keep in mind, that the task force maybe should keep in mind, is that it says if you have a balance on account. And so what you're describing to me would not lead to a balance in an account, because those would be reportable in-kind contributions. But I would argue if they had any kind of other contribution or activity, that all of those in-kind contributions that occurred would be required to be filed.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Madam Secretary.
Yes.
2 points that Justin and Daniel raised. Justin raised the key point is you don't know. So they can spend all this money, and if they don't tell you, there lies the crux of the super PACs. And Daniel raised the issue on the constitutionality of Section 4. The House of Representatives has a rule that prohibits the accepting donations during the session. The unfortunate situation is it's an undefined rule. Nobody knows how to define it, and so therefore it is not enforced. And then for everybody's consumption, there is a third entity out there called the Capital Club, which are the registered lobbyists that are registered with the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, and they have a rule, and a lobbying rule, that says that lobbyists can't donate to legislators during the annual session. The unfortunate situation is once again, as Jennifer pointed out here, there's a lot of volunteerism in how you report in this deal, and I don't think Jennifer's but one deep, so therefore no one's going to go to New York or Massachusetts to figure out where they came up with the $300,000 they spent in Oregon. Money in politics. Thank you, Madam Secretary.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just a very technical question. I noticed some deadlines are business days and some deadlines are calendar days.
That's correct.
So that means that that could be a little messy tracking on that.
Just, if you're correct in that the reporting requirements for Orstar transactions is based on calendar days, but if that deadline falls on a weekend or a holiday, the statute provides that it should be filed by the next business day. Even though you can file 24/7, right?
Right.
But it does fall to the next business day.
And I assume that business days exclude official state holidays.
That's correct.
Okay.
Madam Secretary,
Norman.
I understand that the definition of person includes not just an individual, but really any group of people, corporation, trade association, any group of people you can think of, that this definition is used throughout the statute. And in particular, I wanted to zoom in on the independent expenditure in that it requires any person to disclose some amount that they spend over $750. However, those transactions, I understand, are handled differently from other kinds of entities or persons that are required to disclose as political committees. They don't have to disclose like contributions that they might have used in raising that money to spend as independent expenditures. And so there's a lot of dark money that could come into the independent expenditure avenue. And some committee named the Committee for Good Oregon Government might be able to spend any amount of money but not have to disclose any amount of fundraising that it actually did for that expenditure. Is that correct?
Jennifer is going to make an effort to answer, and you might. I know that one of the issues, I'll save my question till later. Folks have raised the issue of pass-throughs in some ways, too, and that may have some implications here as well.
So I would respond by saying that an independent expenditure filer under the law is not a person that's soliciting monies to make those independent expenditures. Their source of monies is a single source. So if I'm soliciting contributions to make political expenditures, I meet the definition of a PAC. I don't file as an independent expenditure filer, and that's where I would draw the distinction, because you have to look at the definition of a PAC. So it says two or more individuals or a person, which could cover the corporations and those kinds of organizations, that solicits a contribution or makes an expenditure for the purpose of supporting or opposing a candidate, measure, or party. So if I'm soliciting contributions for political purposes, I have to file as a PAC and I have to disclose my contributors. An independent expenditure filer is Jennifer Hertel Corporation, which has my money in a pot, and I don't say to my employees or my friends, hey, I want to support Norm's candidacy, please give me money. I just simply, either if I write a check to you directly, obviously you're going to report that as a contribution. If I conduct an independent expenditure campaign in support of you or in opposition and my expenditures exceed $750 because Jennifer's corporation is writing those checks, then I would be disclosed as, and register as an independent expenditure filer and record my expenditures.
Okay, so the distinction is that if I'm soliciting contributions for this political activity, then I have to file as a PAC.
Yes.
But if I just happen to have a lot of money that comes from someplace, that hasn't been solicited for that purpose, I can go ahead and do it as an independent expenditure?
Yes.
Okay. So there's an important distinction there.
Clarifying questions that folks have?
But, Madam Secretary, sure. I think the issue that you're really driving at here is and was raised by Brenda here, is if you're spending $1 million in an entity like that and you don't file, I mean, the chances of one getting, I guess, caught, so to speak, and actually tracked down its own existence because of the penalty side, the lack of resources and everything else are pretty slim. And so the real answer there is that many organizations that you're talking about placed in the 501c categories and others simply do it because their lawyer says even if we do get caught and we have to file, oh well, it's cheaper to do that than it is to have ourselves drug through the mud.
I agree.
We'll talk a little bit about that as we had also been asked to think about ways that the system is and isn't strong and things that you might want to consider. That's exactly
that. And clarifying, Madam Secretary, I just want to point out, it's the legislature that hasn't done anything, so don't blame the Secretary of State's office. Okay.
Oh, for sure.
Okay. It's more, you know, we're in this soup together. How's that now? So we also had asked folks, unless there's additional clarifying questions, and I'm sure somebody from the elections team will stay throughout our meeting, so we'll always have a resource to do that. But did want to kind of help to start your discussion by, Aaron had kindly asked the team to think about what their conclusions are about our current system, and they have some and I have some. So Jim, Brenda, do you want to talk about the things you'd like to kind of say in summary about our system?
Madam Secretary, Senator Boquist, members of the committee, Jim Williams, Elections Director for the Secretary of State. I would just like to point out and kind of highlight a couple of the slides that Brenda had in her PowerPoint, notably the one that mentioned the transaction information and how much information that we have available as part of our ORSTAR tracking and reporting system. Campaign finance was one of the original modules of ORSTAR. So Oregon had been a pioneer and a leader in campaign finance reporting and transparency for a while. We feel really good about the system that we have, and I'd like to note how far we've come and just how much that we do report and how much is available for the public to search. That being said, we do recognize that there are some technical issues. We've recently been looking at some performance issues, the upload speeds of reporting transactions and things like that. So we know we have some technical issues to deal with, and I know that this committee is taking up some very good policy discussions, but some of the specific concerns that I think that I get highlighted, I get told a lot about, are the limitations in the search function for the public, the public's ability to search kind of at their wish and you know, the way that they would like to for things to appear. So that's something that that we're working on. I also wanted to highlight, too, that as this task force is meeting, we also are in the middle of some consultant work evaluating the ORSTAR system and taking a close look at the campaign finance reporting module and maybe some other ways that we could change business practices and do some things internally that would improve the system. So it's always at the forefront of our mind, but pretty much I say we really feel good about what we have and what we make available to the public, but we're always open to some new policy decisions and discussions. Brenda, do you know of any other specific issues that you wanted to highlight for?
I know that, like Jim had previously said, that there has been some issues with uploading transactions from committees that instead of filing them each transaction individually, they upload thousands at a time, which kind of at times, depending on how many transactions are filed, it kind of slows the system a little bit. But we are aware of that, and we are working on trying to improve that upload situation.
Anything else? Go ahead.
Currently, I just want to clarify when somebody spends on or expends in support of a candidate or measure, and they're a committee that supports multiple candidates or measures, there's currently no way to tell which candidate or measure they're currently supporting in the expenditures. So that's correct, that's the case.
Well, they indicate on their statement of organization.
I think what
but not to the individual expenditure.
I think that what you're referring to would be like our miscellaneous committees, which that's like the bulk of our committees, you know, which I say miscellaneous committees, you know, are organized because they all support, you know, riding buses or whatever it might be, or doctors, you know, or lodging and restaurants and stuff like that. And so for miscellaneous committees, it would be pretty crazy to have to, in my personal opinion, to have to list on their statement of organization that they're going to write a check to candidate A, B, C, D, A through Z. I mean, really and truly, the information is available. You can go into that committee's transactions and look and isolate, you know, their expenditures, and you can see who they're writing their checks to. I mean, that is publicly available online. And in fact, I think that when they're writing a check to a registered political committee, another candidate committee, that in the search, if you're looking at it on the single search page, that information is highlighted, I believe. So it's like a hyperlink to that committee's actual, to their activity. So I get what you're saying, that you can't identify a miscellaneous committee that is support candidates they're supporting on the face of the name of the committee. You actually have to drill down and look at their campaign finance activity, you know, their transactions.
So there's also in-kind contributions, which I've noticed in a lot of cases, you kind of expect to see that. Like they do a big mailing, it applies to five candidates. In theory, the other side's supposed to take like a ratio, right?
Correct.
Of that, and then mark it as an in-kind.
Correct.
But on the original, it doesn't point to the five individually. And a lot of times I see that I think in some cases it may not be properly reported on the other side too.
That's definitely a possibility. In terms of a transaction, so if I do an expenditure, let's say that I'm going to send out a mailing for five candidates, and I do it to ABC Printing, with what the law says is that as the committee that's making that expenditure, they're supposed to identify in that expenditure that those are in-kind contributions, name the five candidates and the amount attributable at two. And I think in our public, same for an independent expenditure, they're supposed to do that. Independent expenditure information, which currently in our public search is not something that you can export, which is it's a desire that we are able to get that information out there. It's a logged enhancement that we would like to see for the public, you know, so that they could do an export and see when a transaction includes that information. But I would like to sit with you, and we could do a public search together, and then I can show you what I'm talking about, or maybe you can show me what you're saying.
Yeah, in particular, it's when you do the search, because right now I do like every 4 hours I try to extract the latest transactions, but I don't get all the detail I get on the individual pages.
I agree with that statement. I know. So,
but that's a good. Let's identify that as one of the issues around the search. Challenges there. That's it's good stuff to have on the list. Kyle?
Covered.
Okay. Good.
Have we got another question?
Front left.
As we've been talking about in-kind contributions, can we just briefly describe what it is, what triggers an in-kind reporting, and the notification from one? Because it is you have to notify the party that you've made that in-kind. Can we just kind of set the parameters up around that as we have brought it into the discussion? I just want to formally define it for everybody if you are listening or are not familiar with this.
Okay, Erin. Let me just grab something real quick here. So in terms of in-kind, it's interesting that you bring that up because we had a discussion yesterday that within the statute itself, it does not define in kind. But we do say within the manual by administrative rule that it's a good or service that has some value to the committee. So in other words, it's something that's provided to the committee with some exceptions, with a single exception, of personal services, I believe. And so if a committee calls and asks an example of what would not be an in-kind contribution. And what we do is we tend to look at the definition of independent expenditure, which basically says an independent expenditure is an expenditure that is not made with a cooperation, consultation, blah, 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 with any agent or the candidate or treasurer of the committee, all right? Which is, you know, a little broad, you know, because you have to think about all those people that are involved with the committee. But if I simply am the candidate for city council and I open up the newspaper on Sunday morning and I see an ad encouraging people to vote for me, and it was put out by the League of Women Voters, but nobody from the League of Women Voters contacted me, had any discussion with my campaign that they were going to place this ad, we weren't in consultation with each other, that would be an independent expenditure and I'm not required to put an in-kind contribution. If I contact the League of Women Voters or they contact me and we have a big discussion about a half-page ad that they're willing to pay for, that is an in-kind contribution. That's reportable.
Could I just say, I'm sure the League of Women Voters wants to put on the record, they never do either of those.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to use that as an example.
That's all right.
Thank
you.
That's all right. In terms of the notification, I gotta find that right here. So notification requirement, I believe, applies to committee to committee only in terms of the time frame for which they must notify. And if you can bear with me, if a candidate, political committee, or petition committee makes an expenditure that must be reported as an in-kind contribution and an expenditure. The committee making the original expenditure shall identify the contribution. Okay, that's not it. That was the deadline piece of it. Can I look into that and let you know? All right, thank you.
And 48 hours. This is one of the issues that I think we wanted to highlight at any rate at the end of our presentation. And I put it in two ways. One is a point that Senator Boquist was making. This is a reporting system, and the violations that there might be are about you didn't report it right. They are not about judging the behavior as such. And as a result, I think the legislature felt it more appropriate to encourage accurate reporting by getting technical assistance out there and making sure that staff are helping people correct filings that are done wrong. And the penalties are, by many people's standards, relatively minimal. And I think that issue was raised last time, that might end up being just a cost of doing business as opposed to something that's actually prohibits that sort of thing. And I, particularly with respect to independent expenditures and in-kind contributions, I want to contrast to, and I don't know the federal system, others of you do know it better, but I think the notion of coordination is a really big no-no in the federal system in and of itself, no matter whether or not the information is provided. We don't have that same statutory system that says you really can never coordinate. You have to report accurately what happened. And some folks have noted that there will be changes in reporting from in-kind to independent expenditure back and forth, because as information comes to light, maybe through a complaint or staff analysis of just the filing itself, you know, reveals something that says, no, this probably should have been done the other way. It's subject to the same reporting penalties as anything else, and somebody's going to kick me here if I say it wrong, because my learning curve is still pretty high. But I think that's one of the issues around the reporting system that comes up frequently at the legislature, and is one that we could have on the table for thinking about making recommendations to the legislature. Is there something insufficient about treating this all as a reporting system and therefore minimizing the necessarily negative impact? We've had the other input, as Kyle raised last time, of some of the challenges for smaller and newer committees. It's easy to screw up in a reporting system, and so do you really want there to be heavy penalties at attached to that. Now, that was kind of the first big issue that we identified, I think, as Secretary of State's team, to just at least have you be aware of and think about whether that's something that you want to address. A couple of the other issues, and these will sound familiar to Senator Boquist and others, the fact that we don't require detailed reporting of contributors who contribute less than $100. The collected miscellaneous contributions under 100 pieces come under a lot of scrutiny and question about whether that's an appropriate way to deal with it. So that may be something the committee wants to discuss. I think a reference was made to there are contributions of personal services that of certain types, attorneys and we can go into it if we do, that perhaps had a seed in wanting to make sure that folks got good legal advice, and it was good to have, so didn't necessarily want to consider them paying contributions for reporting purposes, but that's come up in recent years as an issue, and is there a lot of value being provided campaigns and not detail in the reporting, so that's another. The last one I would put on this list, just in my short experience, is the issue of big contributions coming in very late and our deadlines allowing people to not know about something that happened until after the election date. And Secretary of State's office did submit to the last legislative session a bill that created this task force was originally a bill to require a two-day reporting period, but they got a very difficult. It's a complicated subject, and it has lots of potential, as we talked about in our last task force meeting, for unintended consequences when you move those things around. So it didn't have the momentum to get moving in the legislature, but it is something I think that has been recognized. And I think if y'all did kind of. We look through the NCSL document of all of the different reporting things that folks have. There's a lot of different versions of how people are trying to address those, how large the contribution has to be, how many days, so forth. So that's been a big issue. I asked the team and as Brenda talked about not having to file if you're really truly a small committee and it's going to be less than 750, or the certificate option, they try to encourage and try to help people use. Not knowing what your future is like is probably a hard thing for a candidate or a committee to, maybe there'll be a groundswell and I'll get a lot of money in, so I don't want to, take that out and get in trouble later, but that is an area that has some protection for the small committees, whether that's sufficient or not, I don't know. And I think they found that the biggest areas of confusion or mistake come in the policy of cash expenditures versus what's an account payable, and whether or not those are done well, and people wanting to reimburse staff members or candidates or other folks for expenses related to the campaign, but not providing the detail behind that, so that the transaction, maybe legitimately reimbursing somebody, but we don't know what for, and that detail is something. So, just wanted to get those things out on the table as things that we felt were relevant to this discussion for moving forward. Welcome, Representative Gilliam. We'll try not to shine a light on you, but we're glad you're here. Norman.
Just an administrative question. There's an impressive number of 1.7 million transactions in Orastar. Is there any provision for purging Orastar, or does it go back to the beginning?
It's public record. I suspect we aren't allowed to purge it in any way, shape, or form. I'm sure there's probably an offload way to perhaps take some of it out and.
This will eventually become an issue, probably, because computer systems only hold a certain amount of information unless you keep expanding their capacity. But it's something to think about, anyway.
Madam Secretary.
Go ahead.
I mean, The OraStar system, for those who don't use it, is actually a pretty good system. If you've not used the FEC system, and I assure you that the elections people know my opinion of OraStar some days, especially my wife's opinion. But having said that, it is, other than the normal IT problems, it is actually a very good system compared to the federal system, and it is very good. It is, however, designed on honest transparency, and that is the issue of the whole fines and system and so on and so forth. And so you don't really want to penalize, and the legislature to date has not wanted to penalize the individuals for making, you know, an honest mistake, because I go with the thief thing. It's the lock that keeps everybody honest. It's the issues that I think most of everybody here in the back of their mind are raising, is it's the people who don't participate in the system. That's the problem right there. Miscellaneous reporting, Madam Secretary, you raised, and I mean, members I think should know that miscellaneous reporting of $100 or more are aggregated and put into the OraStar system. The law, though, does say that the aggregator, if it's not the Secretary of State, the aggregator has to keep all of the records by the law. And that there is the crux of the problem. I mean, did you get $420 donations in the very same day, which is not an elected statewide official, who, by the way, are all Democrats, or the Republicans who believe you're actually getting that, and there's no transparency on that. The professional services issue was raised in legislatures, Madam Secretary, you did, and that boils down to several headline wins, and I don't want to beat up individuals because they are, of course, innocent until proven guilty under our system. And then the issue of, you know, late contributions is the issue that has been risen multiple times, is if we want to hide, and we are supposedly honest 90% of the time, we just take the penalty and the fine and do it. I do need to say that in that top control system there, the reason the Republicans can beat up the Democrats and the Democrats can beat up the Republicans is, generally speaking, both parties are pretty transparent. That's not the issue. The reason the unions can beat up the other side, or the anti-people can beat up the unions, is they are generally transparent. It is, once again, these other controlled committees, which aren't on the list, Madam Secretary, who have professional treasurers who are really outside the realm, and what I think most people would say super PACs or entities like that. And I would add to your list, Madam Secretary, that definition of what is a controlled committee and what are the responsibilities of the treasurers. Because in this modern world of miscellaneous committees, I am a rarity in the campaign deal in which my wife is my treasurer. Lee Beyer, who's on the opposite side, he is his treasurer. We are rarities. Most everybody in the political realm has a professional treasurer who's does it for a living. And so what is a control committee? What is the definition of treasurer? And should you hold this professional person who's simply executing the transactions accountable in a miscellaneous or political action committee liable? Or is it really the individuals who are putting the money in and doing it who are held harmless? But again, our system right now, Madam Secretary, as you point out, is based really on honest reporting. It is the other section that is the problem that is not in our law.
Hey.
I think Senator Boquist answered my question, but just for clarity's sake, when you were going through your list and getting to the $100 disclosure issue, I think my understanding is the concern is just what you described, which is that it's kind of on the group to declare that a donor has exceeded the $100 limit over a series of small contributions, although the Secretary of State, I know, can audit, but nonetheless, it's mostly on the donor. I could be wrong about that, but although I think, anyway.
We had a good discussion about it.
Yeah,
should we do audits, and what are the resources for that? That's one of the potential recommendations.
Right. So my question is really: is there any other concern with the rule that contributions that are $100 or less don't have to be itemized? And if so, I would just encourage that we have a conversation about that, because at least I, for one, think the principle of not itemizing those small contributions is a good one. Although I do share the concern about making sure that, you know, there is some good system of verifying when contributions aggregate above, if we feel like not confident that that is that all parties are honoring what the rule says.
And just let me clarify, when a complaint is filed, there is an effort to, and there's some evidence to the complaint that to move it forward. The somebody will jump up and down when if I say this wrong. We do have the authority to come and ask for the detail there. Not everyone puts the individual contributions in. Most do at this point.
Absolutely.
Already do, and then let the system help them trigger the $100, but some keep them on a spreadsheet, you know, somewhere else, and we do have the authority to go and look at that. So the question, I think, that was raised during session was potentially proactive, you know, quarterly audits or regular kinds of, you know, ongoing as opposed to complaint driven. And I guess that's the other thing to identify about this system, that looking behind, unless there's an obvious something in the review of the transaction that flags a problem, an insufficiency, whatever, what the Secretary of State's office at this point is driven by is there's a complaint, and a complaint with some credibility to it that causes us to take an investigatory step. But it has been suggested that perhaps regular audits.
Madam Secretary, to your point, to my knowledge, the discussions that have transpired in the legislature are not to end the miscellaneous. In fact, they've been the other way, that maybe the miscellaneous ought to be raised to $150 or something more realistic in the 21st century. The issue has always been is the aggregating of those. And again, I mean, the vast majority of the parties, the unions, everybody else aggregate them with the Secretary of State's office. It's the other categories where you have an organization raising $1.2 million over a three-month period in $100 or less donations. And there is no authority, at least most of us legislators agree, for the Secretary of State to go investigate that unless you have, quote, the smoking gun in your hand, because they don't have any probable cause, because you are innocent until proven guilty. The only issue is, should not the Secretary of State be the aggregator? And that way, you know, there is a honest person in the room, because we are based on honest transparency.
So while we're talking about the miscellaneous aggregated contributions, I'd like to make a recommendation that we do, in fact, increase that limit from $100. And I would like to see it go to something much higher, because maybe $1,000 or so. Because I think that there's a great value in privacy of political contributions, because there can be grave social consequences for people if they give to organizations that are unpopular within their circles. Like if you are from a very conservative family and you want to give money to a gay rights group, or if you are a member of a union, but you want to support the other candidate, there could be real consequences for you. And we recognize via the secret ballot that it is important to have privacy in one's political contributions and their political activities. But requiring reporting public records for even $100 is going to chill a lot of people from participating in the political system. And what we really want to look at are, who are the big players? Where's the big money sloshing around from? So if you're going to give less than $1,000, is that really the kind of thing that ought to become public record, or should we let people keep that private? And I think we should let them keep that private.
Could we get a sense from the Elections Division how frequently fines are assessed and how frequently those fines reach the 10% maximum?
Give an estimate and then
just
provide
ballpark.
Some...
provide that information, but we need to confer with our application administrator to get that information for you, but we can get that.
Yeah, if you could get that back for our next committee meeting, I think that'd be helpful.
Madam, I have two sort of questions. One on, as Senator Boquist alluded to, there's an assumption of honesty in reporting. So when we deal with independent expenditures, we're assuming that everyone's being honest, that there's been no coordination with a candidate. Is that correct? Okay. Then secondly, and this is a bigger question that I'll ask the Elections Division staff, that they may decline to answer. Have at this point you picked up on any loopholes, as they say, that are big enough to drive a truck through?
I have not.
Okay.
I'd actually like to jump in. There is one loophole that we've noticed is that if you have multiple if you have an organization that has a PAC, what you could potentially do is make a donation to the organization, which could then make that donation to the PAC, which could then make that donation to a candidate. And an org chart only shows up as coming from the original organization to the PAC. So if you have, want to make up a name of an organization, so don't impugn anyone here.
Nobody wants to be that.
Yeah, right, exactly. You know, just as an example, the Red Cross, obviously Red Cross doesn't make political donations. But if I made a donation, if I made a $50,000 donation to the Red Cross PAC, and then they made that donation to a candidate, that would show up in OrStar, which is great. But if I made that donation to Red Cross organization, and I just implied to them in conversation, I'm really concerned about this one election, and then they made that $50,000 donation to Red Cross PAC, and Red Cross PAC made that donation to an individual, all that would show up in OrStar is Red Cross to Red Cross PAC. So that does seem to be a loophole in which a lot of, which you could drive a truck through theoretically. There are actually a lot of states that have begun addressing that, and that's just typically a pass-through donation. But that's one that does strike me.
You talked in maybe of a second question too, Dave, but back to it, but we talked about, and I'll reinforce that it's the honest reporting of it as opposed to the doing of it that is, you know, a problem under our system to go after. There could be implications for their tax status of those various pieces of organization that aren't Secretary of State enforced, but are obviously something. And this might take us back to thinking again about Citizens United and Progeny. Before I move on to others, Dave, did you said you had a second?
No, that was it. The okay. Independent expenditure and assumption of no coordination with the candidate.
Just a question, and then I mean, on two questions, because on Daniel's point, is that considered contribution made in the name of another, or is that not passed through? Because I thought there is a law. So that actually applies to that you can't direct, you know, you can't direct an organization to make a contribution. I mean, you're supposed to follow that law, which is one way they've tried to address
that law.
I mean, that, but it's how do you track that necessarily is a difficulty. But the other independent expenditure, is that based on the contribution, not on the relationship as well? Is that whether or not they have a relationship, they could have a relationship prior, but they didn't discuss that one expenditure? Or is it if they have a relationship, they can't necessarily have a, you know, where's that break as far as specific expenditure versus any coordination whatsoever? Does that make sense?
So
a PAC has a relationship with a candidate,
yes,
and a regular basis has contributed to that candidate, met with that candidate, and talked to that candidate. Can they, at what point can they do any independent expenditure? Is it just based on they've never discussed that one expenditure with that candidate? It's per, I just wanted to clarify, it's per transaction.
That's correct.
Yep. Yeah.
Yes,
what's that going?
Thank you. First of all, I hope we can move ahead today with some recommendations, as long as Senator Rosenbaum and Representative Rayfield are gone. But I wanted to get back to the gentleman over there. Is it Senator Merkley? You know, there are points you made about small contributions I agree with. We want to respect people's privacy and so forth. What I'm worried about is the growth in those small contributions. How do we get a transparent handle on that? The chip-in campaigns are amazing. And to me, we don't want to compare the privacy of a donation with your voting ballot. But we do want to respect folks. But I think we have a problem. I don't want to dump this on our Secretary of State's office. How do you sift through a million $10 chip-ins? But how do you ignore them? We may think one perspective is big money is corporations. Another perspective is big money is
unions, but what about the growing, very clever, I'm interested in, as a candidate, in how do you get those chip-in dollars. But it's growing, and I think it's extremely hard to manage or keep transparency. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, about crowdfunding.
Yeah.
Very important. Seth, I think it hasn't had a turn, and we'll come back to you, Kyle.
So there was earlier discussion on, on the discussion of the $100 aggregation, I think it would be good to require all organizations to file all of them, but let the Secretary of State system aggregate them so you get the privacy on that end. I'm very strongly in support of that. With these little small donation things, you know, like the Act Blue type websites, they have like automatic compliance extracts you can get, and it's easy to convert them into the OrStar system. And second, I've noticed that a lot of committees do what I call cherry picking the date to file, and what I mean by that is they take the contributions they like and report them immediately, and the transactions that might be newsworthy that they think would be bad press and file them at 11:59, as you saw on the slide, exactly. You see the transaction date, it says 11:59:00. They have a computer that basically goes to the very end and files it. And I think one thing you could do to stop that is if they file a transaction, they should file all transactions they've received up to that filing. And they shouldn't be able to cherry pick and delay just because the statute allows them to. So either they need to file them all at the very last moment, or they should be filing them when they know they got them, because a lot of them are just filing stuff on different dates just because they have automation that'll do it for them. I think that's unfair to the electorate.
I'd like to respond to the comments about chip-in campaigns. I would say that if there is a genuine groundswell of grassroots support from lots of people making small donations, that there is no corruption risk from that, and therefore we should not be concerned with great transparency for those kinds of transactions.
I do have a question, if Kyle, could you, Madam Secretary.
Okay, Senator.
Could you clarify? I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I don't even know whether I agree or disagree, whether it's 100, 250, 5,000, or so on and so forth. But do you still believe that in order to keep the honest transparency concept in mind, that if you get $500 from Bob Smith, right, that and you want that information to be private, we have existing laws on miscellaneous. Is that what you're talking about? Or do you want, because I'm in Seth's camp here, of like, okay, if they give 1,000 and we decide it's 1,000 miscellaneous is fine, I still want somebody to have that data behind the scenes to say that this really was from, I don't know what $1 million is over here representing, but my real world example, we had $420 donors today, or was really that a $42,000 check from one entity, and we just lied on the filing?
Yeah, I would agree with Seth. Okay. We need to have the data for all the individual transactions, because that's the only way to accurately report things when you do go over the threshold. Okay. Just don't make it public record until it goes over the threshold to protect those people's privacy.
Thank you, Madam Secretary.
Thank you. Other issues that folks see this is raising, clarifications you think we need? Dave?
Just really quick, not to get into any discussion about it whatsoever, but just if we end up talking, drilling down on this particular issue, I would just want to lay out the marker that I think actually the $100 threshold that we have right now is the right one. So we have a difference of opinion that we should suss out more if it comes to having to make a recommendation.
I would speak to the process side of that. I think as we go through, and we'll do some of from the conversation we had last time, some of that today, that's one of the reasons for our giant spreadsheet is to sort of to take the possible idea and then sort of track through, you know, is there a statutory barrier, constitutional barrier, what are the pros and cons, and so opportunity to discuss that and set it down from issues of aggregation to what level. That's everybody's. But I also think some of the conclusions that you all are talking about are kind of important as well. We need to get to a values piece, we may add to it based on this discussion as well, how we're going to test out these things. Well, thank you to the elections team. I know somebody's always going to be here because we're in your business. Kyle, did you have an additional?
Yeah, I was going to open a new subject. If you wanted to, you can continue your thing.
Okay. I just wanted to give them a bit of ability to go back to daily work to the extent they can. Thank you very much. One of the things we might put in our resources online, I'd just like to put is the original, as introduced version of House Bill 2178, which created this task force but started as a bill for.
Well, Madam Secretary, since you're taking the privilege, you could also look at the minority report, which I am famous for in the last day of the session, which has a lot of the same reforms in it that many of you have raised, which I will caveat in, despite disagreements with the elections division and the majority party, most everybody is in agreement of discussion points within their implementation technicalities. So
we can do that. That's not a minority report on 2178.
Right, I know
it's
it
a
is.
Minority report on another bill, but knows what it is and how to find it.
I can tell you, it's a minority report on House Bill 2176.
Okay. Yes. Thank you. While we're talking about various thresholds, I observe, and since I've been a candidate for legislature, I've had to live with the fact that we have three different tiers of reporting requirements. There's the other under 750, 750 to 3500, and over. And I think it would be a nice simplification if we only had two. I'd might like to make the recommendation that we expand the 750 threshold up to 3500, get rid of the certificate of small contributions and expenditures. Because even at the threshold of 750 today, if you want to run for state legislature and buy your voter's pamphlet statement, then you're already at the limit. And if you want to do anything else that costs money, you have to file a committee, you have to have a bank account, you're exposed to at least some portion, if not the full weight, of the regulatory system that we have. And for these very small campaigns, that are really only a few thousand dollars, what are we so worried about? These things are tiny. So I'd like to simplify the system, raise that limit, and make it easier for people to get into politics by running their campaigns and maybe doing a little bit more than just buying that voter's pamphlet statement.
For the record, that's a recommendation. We'll
match that up against some of the different values that you all expressed and look at how it helps to meet those. Just the one other opportunity I wanted to give folks, if they did have, having looked at the other states and their independent reporting, expenditure reporting rules and timelines for reporting, was there anything that struck anybody as, boy, that's the way we ought to do it? It was complex to go through. At least it gave me a little bit of cross-eyed as I was looking at them. But I just wanted to make sure if there was something that somebody had really particularly noticed. You'll notice the various ways that folks are trying to get at the make contribution issue. It might be useful for us to, if we decide to explore further, to get something around that as one of the impediments to transparency and to kind of pull those out separately and see if we have any recommendation, check with your connections in other states to see if something that people are loving these days about how to do that.
I had one quick question on the ORSTAR system. If people don't provide their employer and occupation to the committee, there's this process where there's a letter that goes out. Is there any obligation to reply to that letter? And if the reply is received, is there any obligation to then report it? I'm just wondering.
So you have to ask for the occupation within 7 days.
Yeah.
And provide that information to our office. So there are no requirement. I mean, it's up to you to obtain that information. So there's no requirement on the elections statute that speaks to what you just spoke about.
So there's no requirement to reply, basically.
Well, unfortunately, I mean, You ask them. It's up to them whether they're going to reply back to you. We don't have the authority to require another entity to reply back to you.
But does the report remain insufficient because it lacks that information?
Yes.
And so there is a potential violation for the candidate or committee
for not obtaining
for
the
not,
information.
For not providing the information back.
So it might
we
be a violation.
We don't have enforcement back to the donor, but we do have enforcement to the candidate.
To the committee, yes.
So it might actually be a violation. Because I've noticed that when we just say, like, yes, we sent the letter, I don't
That's
remember.
The requirement in statute, is that you send the letter within 7 days.
Yeah.
Yes, and so you provide the date. It's sufficient because you've complied with the election law.
I'm not aware of any other insufficiency notice if there's no update.
That's
to that.
Correct.
So it's just not being enforced.
So if they didn't supply the date that they provided the letter, then it would still remain insufficient.
But the fact that they send the letter covers them for any.
And they and they've shown that they sent that letter within that 7 days. They provide the date to the letter.
Yeah. Seth, I'm glad you brought that up because I look at it from a different perspective, and I'm hoping that Kyle will be on my side here. I find it an incredible imposition by the state to require that somebody who gives a candidate $200 to list their employer and their occupation. I frankly don't think it's legitimate state business to know that.
So, I was mentioned, so I do want to jump in on that. I have read some things, and I will send a link in so that we can make it available for everybody for the next meeting. There's been some surveys done about the popularity of various kinds of reporting requirements, and the requirement to identify your employer is actually deeply unpopular. It has negatives like 70%, because people don't believe that it's any business who their employer is,
right.
Or they don't want their employer to be associated with their political activity because it's unconnected. So I will send that information in so we can all look at it later. And I'll go ahead and make the recommendation. We should delete the requirement to state your employer.
Now, I would understand if you're making a contribution at the direction of your employer or on behalf of your employer. Certainly, that's a legitimate campaign issue. But if you're making it as an individual out of your own bank account, I think that that has all sorts of negative connotations requiring listing of an employer.
I just wanted to ask, does this apply to occupation too? You're saying employer a lot.
I think it's irrelevant to campaign contribution from the individual what your occupation is. But I'd flip it around. What is the state's purpose in asking for what your occupation is if you're giving $200 to Norm's candidacy?
I think they can be considered as two separate issues. I think there's a stronger case to say you shouldn't have to state your employer. There's also a case to say you shouldn't have to state your occupation.
Yes. Just some personal observations, and I guess Kyle, you've run for office, so you're familiar with these problems, I guess, and obviously Reverend Gilliam is here. There is nothing in the law that prevents. This is an interesting thing. Say you work for Acme Construction, and the reason they have that law in place is you're the CEO and you walk into the meeting your employees and say, "We really like Kyle over here, and we really think you guys ought to consider helping him out." Because, you know, future of the company is in Kyle. That's what the law is presented. So suddenly you get 50 donations, you know, for Kyle from the same company. And the question comes down is that coercion, which is illegal, but almost you can't prove. That's how that came about that goes into the system. The problem, of course, with that is the reverse. And I've actually experienced this in my campaigns. And I don't know about Representative Gilliam. But you get some people who are overzealous, so they find out that Kyle's donor is Acme Construction or whatever, and they know the owner of Acme Construction, and they go tell him you really shouldn't be donating to that. And we literally have had candidates on either side, it's completely nonpartisan here, you know, get who's not the candidates, their supporters get overzealous and then go out and start, you know, pressing on those people. So there is a fine line of, you know, again, once it's been for Kyle and you, is it the issue of a $100 donor or a $1,000 donor, and what's the relativeness of the two of those, and how do you do that? Because it can get pretty ugly out there in some of these campaigns due to that information. And once again, since it's innocent until proven guilty. But I'm certainly with you. It has ramifications because dozens of campaigns have that problem where it happens. And again, that is not something that's under the subject of the jurisdiction of the Secretary of State. Most of that's under civil court. So unless Kyle and I have $1 million to go hire a trial lawyer, not much we can do about it.
This conversation, I think, is really interesting because it seems to be, we seem to have a challenge here about how to maintain a certain amount of transparency, necessary transparency in the system. And at the same time, as Kyle has alluded to, and I sort of like his suggestion of increasing the thresholds for penalties, of how do you also open up the system to provide greater opportunities for people with limited resources. I don't think there's any real easy solution to how you try to balance both of those.
You're going to have to do it at some point here. When we go over work plan and other things a little later and talk about, try to add to or complete our values discussion, I think each of these ideas people have will want to try to match up with those, and we certainly did have some already, and more people participating, and folks with fewer resources participating, and are these things barriers to that versus the public perception problems? Does changing those things respond to that? So we'll do a little bit of that balancing when we get to it. We did want to hear from, have an opportunity, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to add a very small part to the reporting about what your occupation is. I'm an attorney, and so if I put down lawyer, and they do run reports like where did the majority of their funding come from, so they came from lawyers, but there's all kinds of lawyers. I mean, so it can actually provide you misinformation. At my law firm, four of us are OTLA members, but on the other hand, we also have small business lawyers too, so they may actually give to different people. And if they say, oh, so-and-so's candidacy is 15% of their money comes from lawyers, it may be misleading. So I'm not sure how much value there is in reporting that.
We did want to hear from the public, and we do have at least one person who wasn't able to be here that wanted us to call them so they could, before, and we will take a break here pretty soon, but thought we'd complete.
Right.
Okay. Okay, that makes sense. Our committee administrator knows her business, and trying to get somebody on the phone can sometimes be the thing that stops us cold. So let's have our break now, come back at, can we say 22? Again, we did manage to bring coffee this time, so feel free to get some of that. But take a break and we'll come back.
What's that?
What a good, lovely conversation. I think it's a really useful part of this, part of the process. But also know that not everybody wants to be here until 1 o'clock, and so we'll try to move forward and get our work done. So we haven't been able to reach our witness who wanted to speak on reporting issues. We may reach them later and kind of interrupt and get that extra piece of information into us as we move along. But I'm going to turn to our brilliant committee administrator here, who's kind of devised a wonderful system for us to work through. First, to talk about our agenda, which is our agenda going out, which is this document here, and walk us through that and perhaps amend it as we go.
One of the things we sent out as part of and posted on OLIS was the work plan, just so you can see where we're going, the dates, and kind of the plan for what topics and when we're going to be taking up those topics. And looking at just forward to our next meeting, we'll talk about limitations on contributions and the world surrounding that constitutional amendment. You know, how we get at that. Is that something that is
a recommendation we want to make. Also, talking about public financing and different ways states have approached public financing systems, I would ask if anybody has any great resources in terms of either a speaker or a we've gotten one report that to share that with us, because we look to outside sources, as Oregon is not. Have a public financing system as they have in other states, and so we do want to see how that is working. So please feel free to let me know if you have any great resources on that particular issue. One thing that we will be adding to this work plan for our next meeting is we will revisit the ideas that have come out of today's discussion about possible recommendations regarding the ORSTAR reporting system. And we will have those recommendations in a kind of a bulleted format, so we can see and then consider which recommendations we want to explore more and in more depth, or which ones maybe do not meet our values of the task established by the task force. So, and then finally, our December 10th meeting, we will focus on finalizing our recommendations and finalizing which ideas we want to move forward, either in a bill format, either in a conceptual format for future work, maybe after the February session, as this task force will still be able to meet. Should it still want to do and feel their work is not complete, we can pursue those ideas then. Or if there is specific policy changes that can be put into a bill for 2016, we can look at those as well. So this is just kind of a calendar so we can kind of keep track and know where we are at in this process. And then secondly, what we want to have a discussion on now is looking at kind of the charter, and what it's based on is kind of the four major policy areas that we established at our last meeting, starting today with reporting contributions and expenditures and independent expenditures, and then we'll be looking at limitations on contributions and expenditures, particularly how do we limit them, can we limit them, and public financing. We had an extensive discussion about what the problems were, and that's how we distilled kind of those four broad areas. I do, you know, I don't pretend that I have captured and articulated, you know, to 100% detail everybody's, you know, the problem. So feel free as we go through our discussion and work through this, if there are problems that are not articulated in those areas, so we can see what we're trying to solve as we go across. I know the chair provided kind of a list of values, and we'll want to have that discussion here shortly within each of those areas. What's the value we're trying to achieve with reporting? Transparency, privacy, kind of balancing those issues. Same with independent expenditures, and work our way that way. As you can see, we will fill in here current statute, applicable federal statutes, case law. Dan did provide the case law, and he did kind of group it based on this charter, so we and I will fill that in as well. If you have this document online, all of those case laws are actively linked to an articulation of that case law, so it is linked out, so you can go and look at that issue. And then what I will be completing after our meeting today is the possible policy recommendations around reporting and contributions and around independent expenditures that we will revisit on November as we look towards our final recommendations. And that will be kind of a good way, that is a kind of a front page, as I'll call it, to our report. A person can look at our issue, our value, the problem, what we used as our, you know, what we used as our basis for case law. And so in a snapshot, they could look at this document before they go in and go through our final report. So they can kind of look across and just to keep our work moving that way. And so for our discussion today, I want to make sure, and the chair would like to make sure, we have articulated the problems and articulated our values, because that's what's going to drive ultimately some of our solutions. And so if you have this document, which is the values that we distilled from our last meeting, just wanted to discuss those values, and have we articulated them correctly? Is there something we're missing, either as it relates to a broad, you know, general value or a more specific value within these policy issues? And I will turn that to the chair, and if she wants to go through the values. Or
Well, you can read them pretty clearly. I don't know that we probably should make sure that there aren't any questions about these, or they seem false or opposed to things that you put against in my mind. And I really appreciate the work Aaron's done to have this attach them to the issues, and then we'll attach them to the recommendations. There were some things we wanted to avoid in our outcomes, as opposed to in addition to things that we thought were kind of goals to be reached or positive ones. I'm going to just throw out one that I think is missing here that has been on my mind. We do have a leveling the playing field issue, kind of based on, I think, a fairly mutually agreed upon understanding of public perception and the concerns of the public, whether, you know, some also some indication people feel that it's actually a very real problem, others whether it's a real problem or not, it's a perception issue, that leveling the playing field is important. But and this may be a little bit more political in some respects, but from my perspective, I think it's really important. You all are representing various categories of constituencies that work with these issues, but we also have folks, you know, a broader set of folks. It seems to me that very often campaign finance reform discussion gets hits rocks and gets, you know, high-centered because one kind of campaign or another feels this bites harder on them than it does on somebody else. So I'd kind of like to add a bullet, with your permission, around fairness that sort of looks at it broadly and we're trying to not, you know, name names and point fingers too much, but if it's labor, if it's the business community, if it's the way the environmental community does its work, if it's the way the parties do their work, what kind of change are we promoting? Does everybody have a dog in the fight? Is everybody going to be impacted in a way? I might have my own biases as to what I think are most important, but I think it's really important to if we're going to be successful, to have there not be somebody who feels like that particular thing is aimed right at me. Because if we want our recommendations to be taken up by the legislature, they're going to have that discussion and are going to want to know and are going to want to have, you know, the sense that there isn't they're not picking on some folks and letting others off the hook. Maybe a hard one to hit, but I'd like to add sort of that a little more general concept of fairness to our values list. Norman?
I think I can remember case law that essentially says that leveling the playing field is not a legitimate government interest. Fairness, though, is a little different in that the equal application of the law should be the value, maybe not fairness as such. I'm not sure that I even know what fairness is in this context, but equal application of the law, I think, is a more concrete concept that we could probably work on.
I just have a question for Senator Boquist and Representative Gilliam. Looking down the road in terms of what the task force reports to the legislature in December, is what do you think the legislature would like to see coming from us, so it isn't just simply thank you and put it on the shelf?
Can I offer to make sure that we put Senator Rosenbaum and Representative Rayfield on the spot for that same question? Or if Representative Gilliam actually had the idea that he could set the agenda by...
Knowing that the Senator and Representative Gilliam do represent the entire legislature here today.
I looked at your card. I realize you do. I think the intent, and I think this is a bipartisan or nonpartisan, the intent is to try to get a broad spectrum of ideas. You know, you never end up with consensus in this building, by the way. A broad spectrum of ideas that are articulated you know, for a better word, that gives a shopping menu. It's always nice to have clear and concise, but it's a 30-day session. And I know we're all scratching your heads, and I mean, Madam Secretary knows the restrictions you have on the number of bills and what's going to happen in the 30-day window. But I think that, you know, if you look across all the members, it's not something voluminous, because there's at least a dozen people in this room that will come make it voluminous in our offices that I don't know that are sitting in here. So it's just really the legislature is looking more for, you know, what are the concerns that have been articulated, and how broad of support and what is the level of those concerns. If you come in and say, we want to do X, Y, Z, that is always problematic on both sides. And so I do know what good counsel has said about problems, values, so on and so forth. But in a 30-day session, most legislators are going to go to the right-hand column and say, okay, what was sort of the consensus, and what were the left and right sides along that line? And, I mean, I like you, and like, I guess Norm down here, I'm not sure where. I understand what Madam Secretary said in terms of fairness as an example, but I don't know where that's plugging in into the value, into the four blocks we have right now. So I'm just struggling with that. The thing I will be bluntly honest with you, and Diane Rosenbaum and Lincoln can say is this, I raise an eyebrow, especially the ones that know this, is we're going to be in session for 30 days. I'm not sure how much of a major campaign finance bill is going to happen in a 30-day window. I don't care. It doesn't really matter. I have a feeling we're going to be dealing with Oregon Health Authority, DHS, ODOT, and about three other crisis management issues. So I just don't know.
I would just respond, Madam Chair, by saying I hate either preceding or following Senator Boquist, because I always lose. But I agree with what he said. In the big picture, I think everybody's talking about transparency. Now, we've already experienced how hard that is to get down in the weeds and figure that out. But I think everybody wants more. I don't think anybody in the legislature expects one task force to fix it all, and particularly on this subject. But that word is important. Two other things I would mention are, I love that the Secretary of State is pulling us back, even though it may be obvious, to focus on fairness. Again, how do you define that? But getting that back to the fundamental part of what we're trying to do in elections and in finance of elections, I think is a great reminder. On the practical side, I'm not going to give a presentation on this. I think Newt Pueller will later. But you saw the handout. That's something I think we could discuss, refine, but it's an actual hands-on that I think would affect financing campaigns.
And the reason I ask that question is simply because hearing from Senator Boquist and Representative Gilliam sort of how the legislature sort of views this task force and what we're doing is going to shape how we proceed from here. If we want to produce something that's going to be truly effective in some way.
And I draw attention to what our committee administrator reminded us, which is that while we're required to report relevant in December, relevant to the 2016 session, the task force does not die at that time. It actually lasts past my tenure as Secretary of State, actually, through June of 2017. So we can be thinking short-term and long-term at the same time, and many of the more difficult things or the laundry list that we aren't really quite ready to put forward could be, you know, further refined and build up into a separate set of recommendations around the 2017 legislative session when they feel like they have more time, but it always ends up being shorter than wanted to. But I think recognizing some political realities is an important value to have here. And I think in the first meeting, I reminded folks that we're not the only game in town. Legislators did ask for this task force to be formed. Some of that came out of a discussion around specifically campaign contribution limits and the necessity of an amendment to the state constitution if the state were to move to there. And I think there is some interest in getting this committee's opinion around that for the 2016 session. I'm not saying somebody's going to move ahead and do it or not do it because of what we say, but I do think they're looking for us to send some kinds of signals around the how well we think that addresses some of the problems that we or might address some of the problems that we've identified. And there also are and is initiative possibilities around this that may be going on, and hopefully we'll hear something from those, and those will be totally separate from what we do. Archie.
Yes. So I would hope that when we finish this job that we remember that it should be an open process, there should be transparency, and there should be accountability. And I wish we would also remember that the public, we're dealing with those people who contribute to this process, their money, and they are participating by the number of contributions that are being reported. So we have not only open transparency and accountability for our committees, the PACs, the candidates, but also for the public who participates in this process. So we don't want to forget that there's another group out there that are making all of this possible. They're the contributors, they're our donors, and we hope that each of us are honest, open, and transparent to our donors. And we're dealing with government or us deciding how much they can give, how much they have to report. So that's another side that I know that some of the people sitting in here are representing those people themselves, not necessarily a political action committee or a party. So just hope that we understand that they are the biggest player in everything we do.
To not only, I think we will certainly add transparency and accountability on our own processes, and folks will give us feedback about how it's being documented and how people are able to participate. You know, to the extent you all think past your organizational place to what those members and supporters are thinking, we did think about a couple of the representatives we have here on the task force or have access to and are thinking about the way the next generation, and I say that three generations away from me at this point, are coming to this whole process and thinking about it, and some of our emerging communities and our that are becoming more politically active, and we are thinking that we might, you know, do a little sort of summary discussion around those issues as well, because the givers who give now may not be the givers who give in 15 years, and we have systems set up for how people do business at this point, and we can maybe think a little bit about that as part of our process too. So, thank you. So anything here that feels rings false? I'm not saying everybody loves each one of these equally, but
I don't think any of them are bad values. If you remember at the first meeting, though, my sole contribution, it may have been the only intelligent thing I said during the 4 hours, was that my hope is that this committee designs and recommends something that fits real problems in Oregon as opposed to national rhetoric. And I say that coming from a business community perspective. And I embrace the fact that we are outspent in politics in Oregon. And we are a minority in Oregon. There are not a lot of headquartered companies in Oregon. So when I see things, though, like leveling playing field between wealthy and powerful and the not so wealthy and powerful. That feels to me like a national issue, not so much an Oregon issue, where we have small donor PACs in Oregon that far outspend individual large contributions. So I'm just calling out, in my mind, there's a big discrepancy between some of our values here. Not that any one of them is bad or not worth pursuing, but felt like we maybe slipped more onto the national stage than the Oregon stage with some of these.
So thank you, and we did have the last one on the what we want our recommendations to promote. I did put sort of based on realities here in Oregon rather than assumed realities based on national data. We might think a little bit about what other information or helpful understanding there might be. I think that the data we put together for the Senate Rules Committee, Senator Farioli last time around sort of the top 10 givers to each PAC and top 10 givers to candidates. These were statewide candidates. We didn't focus on, it wasn't broken down by legislators. Is, if it's not up, I think it is up to look at. So that might be useful to evaluate with the lens that Justin has suggested for us. And it might be, as we consider some of these recommendations and whether we think it meets the values, ask that question, are we, you know, is that a real issue in Oregon that we see? I think some of what got on the radar around marginalized groups and others is that even through the normal players in the political scene that we see that have a lot of individual money donations, there are still communities that aren't participating at all. And so so that may be one, you know, one piece of that. And also, of course, we talked about public perception, you know, whether or not, you know, you can almost, you know, you want to address public perception sometimes. So I
would absolutely agree with everything you just said. There are underrepresented communities. There is a public perception problem, a huge one. So I'm not proposing to take anything off the table on the values, although I will, and then I'll close. In the larger sheet, the values are stated in a different manner than the one pager. In the chart values column, row 3, it says create economic equity in contributions, and I didn't hear that at the last minute. To me, that says we've put on the table a value that we want public financing, and that I do not agree with. The way it's stated on the other sheet, I think, is a better statement of the discussion. Maybe others feel differently, though.
I think it's important, listening to Senator Boquist and some of the conversation going on here, and Dave's initial question that started this little bit of conversation regarding what would the legislature like to see produced here, is that as we proceed along here and maybe in the final report, the process should not only include sort of the general feeling or consensus of the group, but how deeply held some of those positions are. Because even if you have 60 or 70% of this group that thinks this is a good idea, if you have a very important group or piece that is vociferously against something, it's probably unlikely to happen, is my guess. And so finding things that we are in more general agreement on that don't have a deep-seated hostility towards them might be one thing to consider, at least somehow gauge that level of feeling in the final report. Or in the process, maybe not in the report, but in the process going forward.
Actually, we're reflecting it into the report. We may have taken a different decision about that when we get to that. But I think Aaron reflected last time that we can have a minority report. We could have just, you know, people just object to this. We could have, you know, this was 3/4 of the group was there for this, but the rest were not. I'd like to reflect honestly the. And perhaps identifying by the strength of it, I think some of you, when I talked to you on the phone before this, you know, between 1 and 10, you know, do you hate this? Do you love it? You know, people did come with some varying views of things.
We're born to try.
Great.
Well, we'll as we go through the charter, I think we can sort of, you know, provide some input for the where the values piece might do. These are always going to be kind of open, moving target questions. Because I think ultimately when we get to the recommendations, we're going to want to come back to and say which values does that support, which values maybe does it not. And nothing's going to be perfect. Maybe that's a statement I shouldn't make at this point. But.
I would just ask if anybody has... And thank you for already identifying one that we need to move around or remove. Have we articulated the problems specifically, non-specific, I hate to say it, but specific enough to reporting and contributions and independent expenditures and limitations of contributions and expenditures well? Or does that capture the discussion we had last time as to what are the possible or should be born out of the possible solutions to that problem? That would be my first question across the first problem areas.
I think one thing I'd like to really bring up around the problem around limitation of the contribution of expenditures is just the one issue I think just kind of broadly is really the inability to consider possible solutions because of the constitutional restriction that we have. So the absence of constitutional authorization prevents us from considering a wide array of solutions that I think apply not only to contributions to CANIS, but also more specifically like during legislative session, how you can use political contributions for, you know, within the legislative session itself, can you contribute during legislative session, regulatory actions to, you know, if there's like a violation. So I think like opening up the possibilities to consider a whole host of policy options is definitely a problem I like to add to number three.
Another value for number three, limitations, which maybe is the only value that's important to the United States Supreme Court, is the prevention of corruption of public officials, or help with that.
I'd also like to.
Sorry, you're saying that any particular official is corrupt, but
you're saying present company accepted? Is that the?
He's not even saying president. I'm just trying to understand. I think I understand what you're saying, but what are you saying?
I'm saying that the United States Supreme Court has said that prevention of corruption of public officials is a legitimate government objective that permits limitations on contributions.
Okay, yeah.
Actually, and that's the only one.
Yeah.
Right.
So it falls into Daniel's already that we have a barrier or a you know, something to overcome to establish that corruption.
And I think also the value of one of the values that a lot of our constituency brings to the table is the idea around lowering the cost of elections and that the cost of election are the cost of elections a barrier to people running to. So the issue of corruption, of course, is like one that, of course, is one of the reasons we're here. But also, you know, have elections in Oregon become really expensive? And do contribution limits add a value in reducing the costs?
So at the last meeting, I brought up the idea of considering changing the recusal requirements when there's a contribution made that creates potentially a conflict of interest relating to a vote before them in the legislature. And there was some discussion on whether or not that's, you know, there's some case law and statutes and rules that might apply. But I notice, although we were potentially going to get more information back from council, there's nothing on here about that.
That's true. I think it was hard to figure out sort of what bucket to put in about that. It is on Dan's list to talk to get us a confirmation about it.
Do you want to just call it a fifth one? I mean, it doesn't have to be. I didn't think it really applies to any of the four existing ones.
Or do you want to create a miscellaneous bucket? Because I'm not sure where to stick your fairness one yet, Madam Secretary. Yeah. So, and he does raise a good point. Are there other related issues that ought to be addressed?
They're already planning to talk about this People's Pledge, which is another sort of out-of-the-box solution. So, yeah,
well, People's Pledge shows up in two.
These four categories are too small.
Can I ask, since last meeting was when Senator Rosenbaum mentioned that legislators cannot recuse themselves in votes. Either Senator Boquist or Representative Gillum, are those simply House and Senate rules, or is there actually a statutory requirement that you vote?
Jump in, pro tem.
I believe, and Aaron will probably know more about this, they're House rules. Mm-hmm. And we were talking you know, it's, again, in theory, it's a great thing. It's pretty meaningless, to Senator Rosenbaum's point. All you have to do is declare the conflict, and you can continue to vote. I will say, on the other hand, a wide-open definition of conflict, you could make the case, I think, on almost every single bill for every single legislator, there is a connection to your interest, to your campaign, to your family, to your background, to your friends. It's a very difficult thing. It doesn't mean that there are situations where somebody appears to have been bought and should, in fact, not vote for an issue. How you define that, I would say good luck.
I'm wondering whether, Seth, and whether the part of this does fall into the bucket of reporting, connecting for the dots for the public. It's part of what you're talking about, a prohibition on participation under some circumstance, whatever. Maybe difficult to define, but that we could arrive at, may not seem to just be a reporting issue, but let's keep it in that bucket as opposed to adding another at the moment, just to see whether we can flesh it out. It was one of the questions on Dan's list, mm-hmm. to confirm the statutory piece of it, or whether it's based on some constitutional protection that legislators have, or where it comes from. We should get that. For the moment, let's additional work around the issue of recusal is something that I think we should put there.
I would defer to you on that.
Yes, yeah, but it needs to be in the bucket. It needs to be in the bucket someplace. I think that's absolutely true. We can pull it out separately if we want to. Also, say Senator Boquist had to step out, but excuse me. Do we have? Sorry, interruption. Yes.
Oh dear.
There's been a shooting in Umpqua Community College in Roseburg. 20 people shot, perhaps as many as 15 deceased.
Where? Shooting at a community college in Roseburg.
Oh, Not could any place, but it's always that much more
which
remote
community
when it's
college?
Close to home.
Umpqua.
No.
So we'll certainly understand if people start to scan their devices a little bit and see whether they, their organization is somebody or something that they want to reach out to. Hold a way to respond to.
And I would just say to the point of there are some kind of tertiary issues around campaign that may not seem to have a direct relationship, but redistricting was another one of those issues that, that does play a part in campaign finance reform, but in and of itself is a pretty broad issue in trying to look at and how it impacts campaign finance reform. And that there, so there were several of those kind of miscellaneous, they don't clearly fit into, but they do play into this process and who gives and gets money, that I frankly just didn't know where to put. And so to that extent, I was hoping that when we get some clarity as to, you know, the, there is outlines in the House chamber rules about what happens if a member doesn't want to vote or isn't available to vote and those kind of procedures. It does not explicitly state in rule, and I think it was alluded to at the last meeting, that I was just looking this up, that's in the Constitution that they're required to vote. So we'll kind of suss that out still a little bit. But like I said, there are some of those kind of miscellaneous issues that have a role in money and contributions and elections that in themselves need their own task force, candidly. Well,
we can make them resign instead. Yes. There's other ways.
So it did not go unnoticed. It was just more about kind of looking for a definition of what the problem is and where do we put it in terms of our scope.
About the break, kind of breaking news out of Roseburg, which I assume that's. So everybody, as I said, kind of has permission to be watching their devices a little bit if they want
to. Well, I might have to step out momentarily, which is why the president's
quite all right. That's okay.
I just wanted to observe regarding Seth's idea that since recommending constitutional amendments is actually part of the scope. It isn't necessarily a barrier that the legislators have to vote. That could be changed. That could be part of the recommendation.
We could have like a backup legislator, like the second place winner steps
that's
in.
Right. That's
that
right.
Would make a huge disincentive.
Well, ma'am, on that topic, just one of the interesting things you should note that under the Oregon law, because of what elections put up there, that contribution limits during the legislative session have to be reported within a shorter amount of time, so on and so forth like that. But there actually is no prohibition under Oregon law to buy votes. So literally in my office, according to legislative counsel, pick a lobbyist can, you know, or a company can walk in with a check for $100,000 in the middle of session and hand it to a legislator. And as long as we place that check in our campaign finance account and report it to Elections Division, we can receive a check for $100,000 and specifically vote for a specific piece of legislation in Oregon law.
That's what I'm trying to prevent.
I sponsored a bill on that, by the way. It didn't go anywhere.
I think there are not campaign finance laws against that.
No.
There are ethics laws under which you could take that behavior and get at public corruption, or you found it insufficient.
No, the legislative council found it insufficient. Other than a obscure federal law in which they have backed off prosecution on, that is the only prohibition.
Public corruption.
It's the honest services fraud law in which was used in the state of Alaska and several other places to do it. But no, surprisingly enough, I was in your same category. Well, doesn't ethics and doesn't this, and you know, so it was rather stunning.
Well, as Dan looks at those issues, if he wants to present us with a gap that seems appropriate for the, does relate to campaign contributions, so we can certainly have that. Absolutely on the list. I wanted to kind of draw a little distinction. Sarah Broquist had raised, you know, so where does fairness fall here? The values piece, and Aaron made a valiant effort to reflect how it might appear as we look at the problems, I think is going to be most valuable to us as we evaluate the recommendations. as opposed to a concept in and of itself or something for us to you know, work through as a piece of a work plan. It really is more something for us to test against, that these were the kinds of things that we thought were worthy of at least considering and making sure that we had responded to and we didn't totally ignore it as to our recommendation. So that's kind of where I would put the fairness piece. Whose ox is getting gored, and you know, is it different for some versus others? And at least understanding that, even if people still feel strongly that it's appropriate to put forward the recommendation, that we consider that.
Can I make just an administrative recommendation, and at the risk of making this poor spreadsheet even wider? For me, at least, it would be helpful as we move through these topics to have another column that maybe label it unintended consequence or concerns if reform adopted. For example, if you tamp down contribution limits, independent expenditures pop up, so that we can just have a holding place for concerns that.
Bit longer too.
Excellent.
It's okay. Mayor Boquist and I were opining this morning that some of us, that the font size has got to be at least big enough that we can sit in a chair and read this without.
Madam Secretary, so I don't see anybody sitting around this room that was probably active in the political arena in the 90s when we had. Okay, when we had term limits and we had campaign finance, and I apologize because maybe it was in our first meeting, but I would like to see what the consequences were of those campaign finance limits, and where did the money, when the money could only come to the state parties and everybody else was shut off. Where did the money go? Did it go into independent expenditures? What happened in that playing field? Because we ran one cycle under those restraints. And so I would be interested in knowing where did the money go? If you couldn't contribute it to a candidate because you had a limit of 100 and a PAC had 5, and I was ED of the state party, and all the money ran through the state party. But there was a lot more money out there that did not come through the political committees. So I'd be interested in knowing, did it shift to independent expenditures, or how did we, because we went through a cycle, how did the citizens and the PACs all play in that game? Because that's going to happen again. If we're not prepared for it.
Aaron, to see if we can find some resources that I don't know if a precise analysis mm-hmm. was done and how much it would take to do that kind of evaluation. But you're right, some of the legislators, as we talked about this issue this session, reflected upon their own experience around that. Some negatives that they wanted to make sure were avoided, so that there's something that either legislative committee considered or whatever, that'd be useful.
I think Janice Thompson in the previous iteration of Oregon Common Cause did an analysis like that, and I'm sure it's on the interweb somewhere. Daniel could come and find it, and I think it spoke to some of the things that you're describing.
Thank you. Thank you for offering up resources that we can use that way.
I thought that the representative from the Republican Party was going to put term limits back on the table, and I was excited for a minute.
No.
I want to be generous with our mandate.
Daniel, you're with me?
It was one of the things that was also found unconstitutional, but for one word, lifetime.
Darn.
That's why it was unconstitutional. We can have term limits, but we can't do lifetime.
I'm sure there is a way that folks could look at that again as a money effect, or what the money effect of not having them is, or whatever, but I'd like your permission to have us skip over that one. Somebody is really. Going back to, and Erin is so quick, she's going to find the report just momentarily here, but we were hoping to kind of go through the flesh out on, we will next time talk about the reporting piece and some of the possible policy changes, making sure we fleshed out what we did today. Did you want to skip down to limitations and whether that's...
I think we kind of have already. We kind of skipped around a little bit down there, which is what I'm just trying to make sure that I have interpreted what I heard correctly and did not insert, you know, anything that wasn't intended. And so, so it sounds like we have a couple additions to the values, and you know, I think, and to and a removal of the value under the limitations and adding accountability to our broader, you know, overarching policy objectives. If there is something else that stands out as incorrect or missing from those sessions, and this is not a one, these will evolve, you know, as we keep having these discussions.
Other things that folks felt like were part of our earlier discussion that just simply aren't reflected here?
Would it be helpful to have, you know, in just like the last couple of years, examples of legislation around these ideas? Because Senator Boquist, you spoke about, you know, issues about contributions made during session.
Right.
And that would be helpful model legislation to look at. Of course, we're like all coming up with new policy recommendations here, but you know, if LC or Legislative Council already spent time reviewing a lot of provisions, that could be good.
And absolutely, we can. We have and can provide all of the bills that have put forward either these exact. So some of these will be exact, like the constitutional amendments. We've had several iterations of a constitutional amendment. We could provide those in addition to ideas around increasing transparency, changing like the expedited reporting. We've had several bills around expedited reporting and other ideas that may not be articulated exactly today, but have come up. We can absolutely, you know, at least look back through the creation of ORSTAR and see how we've evolved that system and reporting, and then just go beyond that and look at particularly around campaign amending the Constitution for limitations, as like SJR 5 was 2015's version. We have an 11, we have a 13, we have a 9. You know, so you know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel per se in this committee. Some of these ideas have come forward, and part of that kind of determining, you know, what can be done differently with this idea, or why didn't this work in terms of the articulation of the idea that maybe we could solve here, or at least present a new look at it here.
Just. Since you mentioned SJR 5, just a clarification for me, it looks like it went to the Senate Rules Committee, and that's as far as it went.
There was a public hearing held, which I think in 13 and 11 and some of these others that didn't, that step didn't happen, but there was a public hearing.
Okay.
No.
Dr. Meek, be here for a moment. I'm wondering if
I have not.
Yeah. Don't want to waste time that people have put on their calendar and not get us moving forward. I'm absolutely open to a general discussion again of what if we need to add to our problems list, if we need to add to our things to avoid list. And so forth, we can certainly spend a little time previewing, because I did really want to make sure that in November we talk a little bit more about the constitutional amendment piece, because that's something that would have to go to the voters no matter what. That has a timing component to it, and I think we've been asked what would we think about, not in the legislation, but at least by some state leaders and legislative leaders to consider either the necessity of that or the problems with that as a means that then trying to address some of these things that may be currently limited by the way our state constitution reads. And we had planned to make that the kind of one of the early things up for next time, but we could begin that discussion now with folks, unless folks were eager to get out. I don't want to spin our wheels, but I'd like us to move forward with any remaining time we have.
Curious, were we planning to talk about the People's Pledge issue this time or next time?
Well, I think we wanted to present it this time. I think I'm not sure if Representative Gilliam, who brought this to our attention at the request of Representative Bueller, wanted to say anything about it. I think it's an idea to put before you. I have spoken with Representative Bueller's office, and he wanted to be here today. He simply just could not. But we do intend to invite him to come in and speak to it, as this is an idea he did put forward in a bill. There is a broader national movement around this idea, and I think it stems from the idea that as long as you have a Citizens United, that you need to look towards voluntary agreements amongst candidates, and so that this is one of those ways of maybe getting at some of those, you know, large amounts of money spent with independent expenditures as either an incentive not to do it or a deterrent not to do it. To the extent that if Representative Gilliam wanted to say something, or we could just, you know, take the information we have now and wait for Representative Bueller, that would be at the discretion of the task force.
Madam Chair, I would just say I'm glad you circulated this. It's a start, but please hold your applause. I'm not going to speak.
I wanted to point out that one of the things after Representative Bueller and I met about this topic and during the last session, he referenced a law review article that I then subsequently tracked down and I did put on our resource list. Very interesting read for a law review article, which you wouldn't expect to be particularly entertaining to read. But of course, what part of the analysis there was, again, coming to our assessment of these things was the different circumstances, what might make it work or not work in an individual circumstance. It was a very, if you haven't looked at it yet, it was a very interesting kind of analysis of how it has worked. We've heard informally, and we might maybe posit this question to see if anybody, when we send the agenda out next time, and hopefully Representative Bueller can be here, we might ask folks to test their own resources around that. We've heard informally that although there haven't, since the Brown Warren race, there hasn't been a big race that has sort of relied on this or been a big showcase for this process, that there have been a primary, it has been used in primaries, particularly in Massachusetts, where that idea sprung. And perhaps because some of the political complications around it, inter-party, within the parties, were able to be managed a little bit more effectively. But it is something very popular with the public. And what Representative Bueller discussed with our office was it obviously isn't something that requires legislation, but perhaps the Secretary of State's office or some other office, trusted state agency, could be helpful in providing technical assistance or templates or, you know, information to help people should they choose to do this. So,
I'm fine with waiting until Representative Bueller can be here. I'd be delighted to hear from him. I wanted to just kind of point out that the problem with the People's Pledge is that it is a pledge, a voluntary pledge, and so no amount of legislation probably could require it. But there is maybe legislation that could help with a People's Pledge, say by giving some incentive for adopting a people's pledge by a candidate. Say, for example, putting in the voter's pamphlet that the people's pledge had been taken, or maybe putting together some logo that would go along with the people's pledge and that give them permission to use that logo on all their advertisements, or some other kind of incentive that could be put into law, and that way at least encourage candidates to take the people's pledge. I haven't seen that idea anyplace in the literature that was handed out, but that's something that we can think about.
And some, obviously, choices have been given to folks within public financing systems as well to...
put a question on the table, maybe mm-hmm. to discuss at the next meeting. I just want to make sure I'm understanding the people's pledge correctly. And it's very intriguing, but it says if the independent expenditures happen, the contract requires a candidate to donate 50% of any independent expenditure made on behalf of the candidate. One, it's not always clear that an independent expenditure is on behalf of a candidate, at least in my experience. I'm curious how that's played out in Massachusetts. And then two, the contribution to a charity, is that out of the candidate's campaign fund?
I'll try to take those. I read the law reviewed article, so I have the background on this. The idea was, yes, penalty would be paid from your campaign funds and paid to a charity of the opposite party's
Opposite candidate's choice. Right. So you could embarrass the other candidate.
Exactly. And it actually worked very well in the sense that once they had signed up for the pledge, there were only a handful of independent expenditure ads that happened at all. So they didn't go into problems of there being sham ads and so forth that you couldn't really tell who it was for because they just dried up.
Yeah, sure.
So it is a real problem, but in practice, it did not occur in that case.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Just to echo that, I mean, there was one instance, I forget, it was the League of Conservation Voters on one side, and then there was another expenditure on the other side. Both had to pony up. And then I think the backstory, as I understand it, I talked to the gentleman who ran Senator Warren's campaign, who's the author of that article. Was just both candidates basically went to all the people and just said, stop, 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 stop. You're making me look bad.
I wonder if there are legal issues, though, if indeed the campaign money was directed to a charitable purpose, if there's any legal concerns either from the donor to the campaign or use of campaign funds for a non-campaign purpose, if that happens.
I think in Oregon you can donate to a C3 from the campaign account.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And in a C4, which I assume most of Super PAC money was C4 money, is either directed to.
And this is money out of the campaign,
yes,
the candidate's campaign going to a charity. So if I had given money to that candidate for use in that race, I'd have a problem with that money being spent, especially if the other candidate is directing where it goes to. Mm-hmm. And it's something intended to embarrass. To be discussed at the future meeting. It's intriguing. I like the idea.
It really is, and it just I think that article lays out very well a lot of the considerations that would go into it, when it might work and when it might have its challenges. But I really appreciate that. The creativity that was involved there, particularly as I certainly did hear everybody, maybe not everybody, but I would say a very large set of concerns about independent expenditure money taking over at the point where contributions to candidates and committees is limited. What we want to avoid, what we want to avoid category for a lot of reasons, and I think it's a you have to keep in mind? And is there social pressure to be applied through this kind of contract that could help do that? I would love to get us at least to 12 o'clock, but still doing some useful information, getting some useful information together for our discussion around the constitutional issues next time. I would love for folks to have thought about if, and obviously you don't need to be prepared to talk about it today, but whatever we can get on the record might help us formulate questions for next time. One of the challenges that came out of the legislative discussion this last time was one that I think we've all identified, or many of the reformers the active reform organizations have identified, which is chicken and egg kind of issue. We have ideas of how we might address public perception and real concern about corruption because of the levels of money, but we have constitutional limitations, both federal and even stronger at the state level, to keep us from some of the more obvious things that we have tried to do in the past. There was an effort to have a conversation about trying to resolve that constitutional question that then foundered on, well, but then what are we going to do once we get there? And I think for a variety of sides, lots of different reasons, and the felt need to solve the what is it we're going to propose for reform before addressing the constitutional question. And I wonder if folks have thoughts about that issue in and of itself, because as we come to a place where we might want to make a recommendation by part of us or all of us, none of us or one of us, for the legislature to consider that, I think that's one big kind of knot that has to get untied. And so I wonder if we could spend a few minutes
I would definitely advocate for, if we're talking about what were policies that we could put in place if we had a constitutional amendment. Is that your question? Okay.
And how much of that has to be settled before people would feel comfortable recommending a constitutional amendment?
I'd recommend looking at a court case called Randall v. Sorrell. It was a Supreme Court case decided in the case, I think, Vermont had proposed contribution limits that were viewed as very low. I think that has been provided. And so what is there a... I'm not a constitutional attorney, so I'm not sure the exact extent in which the precedent set by Randall v. Sorrell would apply to limits that we put here in Oregon. But the question is, is there a floor for how low limits can be that would be upheld by the U.S. Federal Supreme Court? That would seem to be a good understanding going into it about what, and I think that's a question legislative counsel can help us suss out to some degree, although there are a lot of different legal opinions on the court case too.
There was the table that we got at the first meeting that summarized state by state what limits passed federal muster and which did not. I think that's sort of a useful starting point.
One of the things discussed in the session, and I think that we may have been raised here as well, was the fact that there is a set of campaign limits still on the books in Oregon, have been struck down as unconstitutional, and would automatically, by amending the Constitution, would those limits come into play. We had Secretary of State's office had proposed an amendment to the constitutional referral that indicated that all regulation moving forward would be governed by the amendment to the Constitution. So there was the opportunity to rethink and start anew in that that discussion. But I know some of the things that we heard from folks were, should there. Might the legislature quickly and do something, I think the legislature wants to hear if there are very severe problems with possible steps that they could take, such that we don't want to open the door for that? Or do we think of it as having a complete constitutional barrier, many people feeling that the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court's analysis of speech, you know, has gone too far in people's minds. Should we make a statement in Oregon about believing that there's that campaign regulation and the need to avoid corruption is something worthy of balancing against the First Amendment, and we want to make that statement first? I'm trying to reflect all the opinions on this, and I'd love for it to be your opinions instead of mine. But Norman.
Another consideration in putting limits on contributions is providing sufficient money to carry on a public campaign that would be viable. If you make the contribution limits too low, then there isn't enough money available for a public information campaign about what the campaign is about. And so you have to kind of think forward as to, you know, how much money could be raised with the limit that is set at some level, and would that be sufficient to carry on a viable campaign? So if you put the limits too low, it would be like an incumbent protection act, and not have a ability for a challenger to have a viable campaign. On the other hand, if you make the limits too high, then you might as well not have any limits, perhaps. So there's some sweet spot in there of providing enough money for a viable campaign, but not providing so much that the public gets turned off the whole process and other consequences occur.
Okay, sorry.
Not that I really want to get into it. My personal bias is not to have a big fight over, or I'm not really interested in engaging in a fight over the low limits thing per se. I feel compelled to, as a counterpoint to Norm's point, is we should remember that if we actually did succeed in some future world where the constitutional questions were dealt with, and this is why I'm not so interested in having this fight, because I feel like it's a very much a future world, but if you did, then I'm not so concerned about not having enough money to spend run a good campaign, because part of the problem, reason why campaigns are so expensive, is precisely because there's so much money in that essentially the marketplace, the cost of running the campaign goes up because of consultants can charge more, you know, ads cost more, everything costs more. But if all of a sudden the amount of intake money was lowered across the board, then just campaigns would become cheaper to run for everybody, and then you wouldn't have that problem. So I feel like we should just remember that as the counterbalance to that particular point.
I think you're making my point, is that there's some sweet spot in there that is a balance between too little and too much.
Just so that I'm completely clear, is I come from the perspective of, I suspect, although I've not seen this in real life yet, so this could be a pipe dream, but I suspect that, in fact, if you could succeed in ratcheting down contributions to truly a level that only ordinary people could afford, like some very low level, like $100. We have not succeeded in doing that, so I acknowledge that. But if you did, and you could do that across the board for independent expenditures, some people might look at that in the conventional political world and go, that's absurd, because you could not run a campaign. You couldn't afford to do anything. And I would make the argument that the entire marketplace, the cost of the marketplace, would just plummet precisely because everybody is in the same place, and campaigns would immediately become a lot cheaper to run and a lot. It would just be a whole different ballgame than the kind of ballgame that we look at right now. So that's my point.
I want to add quickly to that. In addition to lowering the cost of the market, when you take the money out of politics, you'll actually see a huge increase in volunteerism. One of the reasons why we don't have ballot measure collection by signature gathering by volunteers very much is because it's all paid now. Everyone expects to see a paid person. They all think it's bought and paid for. If we actually were able to undo the federal prohibition banning paper signature or banning paying for signature gathering, like Colorado tried to do in 1988, that got overturned, people would be volunteering to go petition, because that's something that would be effective. They wouldn't have to compete against somebody who's paid. So I think we need to take into consideration that we want to allow people to participate on a volunteer basis. Later on, if possible, I've run a bunch of numbers on who's contributing and like percentiles and the dollar amounts and around the limit question of like $100, $200. What are people contributing now? It would be great if the Secretary of State Elections Division could run a report because they have easier access to the data. Mine's limited by the $100 cutoff thing, but I want to add some data, like send you an email, so we can send it out to everybody.
So we're talking about limiting what someone can contribute, and we already met the free speech threshold the last time. But is there a constitutional prohibiting us to set the limits on what a House campaign can spend, what a Senate campaign can spend, what a petition? Because is that limiting speech? I don't know. But, I mean, we're talking about limiting what comes in. Can we limit what goes out?
Unfortunately, I guess that includes a bias. The U.S. Supreme Court has been really clear in that you can't put any limits on expenditures. So a candidate spends or an independent group spends, you really can't put limits on their ability to do so. Most prominently in the Citizens United case. What you can do is within contribution limits, particularly the campaigns, the candidate campaigns, you can limit based on the size of the office. So like if it was a candidacy for a judge or for a state house campaign or a state senate campaign, you can have different limits for those. That is very much legal. You can't also put limits on what you can give to a ballot campaign. So you cannot limit what you give to ballot campaigns. You cannot limit what anyone spends. The only limits you can put in place are what you can give to a candidate's campaign.
And federal election law already does that, but it's the same limit, regardless of whether you're a Congress or a senator.
Yeah, that's correct.
Kyle and Seth have everything, but we'll make sure that when we start up this discussion next time that we have that clarity from council. Just want to say we can't, under current constitutional law, and as Dave indicated, you know, there may be some opportunity to think past, you know, the day may come, and if all of that were changed, not to say everybody wants to advocate for that, but if all of that were changed, the Oregon Constitution would continue to have its own provisions around that. So it's part of this is a discussion of the relationship between the two. And there are things we can do. They might be struck down. That, of course, isn't necessarily always a barrier. So I think Kyle was first.
It would help, I think, for us to look at the constitutional potentials here. First, from the perspective of, do we want the Oregon Constitution to stay within the federal strictures, or do we want to put in sort of the ideal system without regard to the federal limits, even though part of it might not be able to be applied immediately? And that may help firm up the discussion, because if, for instance, people aren't interested in going past what federal law allows, then there are a lot fewer things for us to talk about, and we can concentrate more time on those remaining issues.
And on that point, I think we need to I think Oregon needs to be a model leader and to actually have fairly low limits so that we can be, for example, like we have done in the past, be test cases and actually push the Supreme Court to actually look at some of these issues. I would love to see a lot of the Measure 47 rules stay intact, and there might be some question as to whether or not those are federally constitutional. But we have to realize there are a lot of really old justices that may be switched out soon. So a lot of Measure 47, in fact, Citizens United itself may in fact be overturned very shortly. And by the time it gets up there, the provisions in Measure 47 that would violate Citizens United now, not necessarily the limits, because I think those, a lot of those would actually stand. But the other parts regarding independent expenditures, that we should keep all of that in and then wait for it to go through the process under the expectation that, you know, we may have to defend ourselves, but we should be defending ourselves. We should be the leader, just like we've done a lot of stuff before, right to die issues, marijuana legalization. We can be the, like, a vanguard example for others. And that's my view on that.
We can be, but oh, go ahead.
That's pretty interesting. You know, that we do have, of course, citizen passed limitations through ballot Measure 47, which was, what, 2006. Just waiting for the constitutional amendment in Oregon that would allow them to be implemented. And I'm fairly confident there's going to be one on the ballot in November anyway. So whether the legislature puts it there or it's petitioned on there. So it seems to me this problem might solve itself without any input from us. And perhaps, I guess I'm more interested on the other stuff, the transparency, maybe the public financing pieces like that, because I almost think this is going to happen anyway, and ballot Measure 47 is going to be in there. Legislature will have every chance to amend that, to change the limits if they choose to, you know, after the people passed it. There's been some inflation in 06. I suppose maybe they put it up. But I think this is going to solve itself.
To the point of whether we ought to pursue a constitutional amendment, I think we ought to look at the range of possibilities. I'm certainly not sold on the prudence of us amending the Oregon Constitution, because that opens it up to one legislative changes down the road to whatever scheme we put in place, and to a lower threshold for citizens going to the ballot to change whatever we put in place, because it becomes a statutory scheme at that point, the lower signature requirements. So I would urge a little bit of caution, because whatever we might do if we amend the Constitution, you can't amend it back without having another Herculean effort. You and I had a good conversation about this. I have very mixed feelings about Citizens United. I agree there's too much money in politics. I don't like it that some candidates lose control of their campaign because their separate efforts run. But at the same time, I am a very, very strong advocate for the First Amendment, and I'll go to my grave saying, if I have to spend my own money to advertise my political speech, that is a pure First Amendment right. And I think that's worth preserving. But there are, of course, distinctions in there that we can get at. But long way of saying, I would like to look at a range of amendments to the Oregon Constitution, but I'm skeptical.
Well, thank you, folks, for beginning that. Helps us shape that. I'm not trying to make anything more important than another in here, but I'm aware of what we've been asked to think about prior to 16. And I think you've mentioned before the outside potential, and legislature is kind of looking how to do a variety of people feel about whether or not we try to address in advance or simply respond and wait for the public to work to wrangle this out together. It seems that there's enough agreed upon concern to have a discussion it's worth them having a conversation about it at the very least before ballot measure campaigns, which can be strong and wonderful and elucidate all the issues, and sometimes don't as much. You know, what should our state leadership weigh in on? Would be the say that their information is supreme. So, thank you for that. We can all have lunch and do something else with that 1 hour. I appreciate your keeping it to 1 o'clock on your calendar. I think the time will come when we will need that extra time. I appreciate you.
We'll be back on November 19th, 9 o'clock. We'll be talking about more specifically limitations and what one, if that's the direction we want to go, what do we need to do first and what can't we do, and bringing together those possibilities. If there's any resources anybody would like to have mentioned today and shared with the task force, just feel free to send them to me. I will send them out to everybody and get them posted. And with that, Madam Chair, I can close your meeting and adjourn. Thank you. Close your meeting and adjourn.